The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Week magazine. Today, we're reading from the May 6, 2022 issue of the Week. The cover drawing for this issue of the week is set in Disney World. It looks like it's the iconic Main Street. You can see Cinderella's castle in the distance. Governor Ron DeSantis is sitting on a bench, and he's got Mickey Mouse over his lap, and he's got his hand raised to give him a big spanking. Just behind him, Snow White and Cinderella are looking on in horror, and Mickey's got a big look of surprise on his face. The headline is, Punishing Disney. Florida Governor Ron DeSantis, War on Woke Corporations. We'll pick up that story on the Talking Points page, but we'll start with our first main story. U.S. and NATO pursue a full Russian defeat. What happened? As the U.S. and other NATO nations stepped up the shipment of heavy arms to Ukraine, Biden administration officials said this week the goal has shifted to a decisive Ukrainian victory that would leave Russia's military so weakened it could no longer menace its neighbors. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin and Secretary of State Antony Blinken delivered that message after a visit to Kyiv, where they met with Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky and pledged to help Ukraine drive Russian dictator Vladimir Putin's army from Ukrainian soil. We believe they can win if they have the right equipment, the right support, said Austin. The Biden administration officials announced that the U.S. would soon reopen its embassy in Kyiv, and Austin met with defense officials from 40 nation allies in Germany to discuss how to strengthen Ukraine's military for the long haul. All of us have your back, Austin told the Ukrainians. Russia escalated its threats in response to the growing flow of Western arms. Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov said the West had derailed peace negotiations and accused NATO of fighting a proxy war with Russia that raises the threat of a nuclear conflict. The danger is serious, said Lavrov. It must not be underestimated. His words came days after Russia test-launched a long-range nuclear missile it said would significantly bolster its nuclear capability, a new weapon that Putin said should offer the West food for thought. Russia cut off natural gas to Poland and Bulgaria after they refused a demand to pay in rubles. Russian forces unleashed heavy air bombardments along the front lines and took several dozen small villages, but made no major territorial gains amid fierce Ukrainian resistance. Speculation that Putin may be seriously ill was amplified after he appeared to limp and gripped a table with one hand during a televised appearance with Defense Minister Sergei Shoigu. Some medical experts said Putin's behavior, including twitching foot, suggested Parkinson's disease. What the editorial said: President Biden and our Western allies must not be cowed by Moscow's threat, said the Chicago Tribune. As the war enters its next phase, one certain to inflict even more horror and carnage, Ukrainian forces will need a steady, stepped-up supply of munitions on every level, from ammunition to anti-aircraft missile systems. We must deliver whatever they need while tightening the vise of sanctions on Russia's murderous autocrat. If Putin prevails in the Donbas, he won't stop there, said the Wall Street Journal. Instead, Russia will concentrate its forces and march south. Once a quarter or a third of Ukraine is under Putin's control, he might seek a truce, then bide his time as Western sanctions erode, while readying his army to turn back toward Kyiv. That nightmare scenario underscores the urgency of sending Ukraine the artillery, drones, tanks, and other weapons it needs to press for victory. what the columnist said. Austin's pointed words mark a transformation in America's approach to the conflict, said David Sanger in the New York Times. From the outset, Biden has taken pains to avoid casting the war as a U.S.-Russia showdown. But after the images of Russian atrocities made clear the consequences of even a partial Putin victory, U.S. officials are adopting rhetoric that pits Washington more directly against Moscow. It's a strategy that carries some risks, from stoking Russian nationalism to increasing the odds that a cornered Putin will turn to chemical or even tactical nuclear weapons. The heavy weapons pouring into Ukraine are a game changer, said Max Boot in the Washington Post. They're designed to win the war, not prolong it. The West is sending howitzers, Phoenix Ghost attack drones, armored personnel carriers, Mi-17 helicopters, and 10 anti-tank weapons for every Russian tank in Ukraine. That bodes badly for Russia's already battered forces, which have nowhere close to the 3-to-1 advantage in combat power attackers typically need to prevail against determined defenders. Ukraine can win, said Alina Polyakova and Josh Herbst in Foreign Affairs. That reality has been slow to dawn on Western leaders who believed that even a blundering Russian military is simply too big to fail. But the valiant Ukrainians have demonstrated they can not only hold off the invaders, but also force their retreat. And a clear military victory is within their reach. Western leaders have a moral obligation to stop their hand-wringing about provoking Moscow and give them all the support they can muster. The war has forced a sea change in U.S. foreign policy, said Doyle McManus in the Los Angeles Times. The Biden administration's national security focus has shifted from China to Russia and ended a period of retrenchment in which the U.S. has sought to avoid overseas entanglements. We seem to be speeding toward a Cold War-style division of the world into two blocks, one led by the United States, the other by China and Russia. Controversy of the week is masks. Is America done with COVID mandates? The plane had only just reached cruising altitude when the pilot made the announcement, said Julia Reinstein and Katie Camaro in BuzzFeed News. A federal judge in Florida last week struck down the Center for Disease Control's mask mandate, meaning that passengers were no longer required to wear them on airplanes, trains, and buses. Some jubilant passengers ripped off their face coverings, cheering the change. But it was grim news for the 8 million plus Americans who are immunocompromised or have health conditions that leave them especially vulnerable to COVID. For them, the end of pandemic precautions means a loss of freedom. It was a ludicrous ruling, said Stephen Lube in NBCNews.com, and rested almost entirely on a tortured misreading of one word, sanitation. Judge Catherine Kimball Mizell, a 35-year-old Trump appointee who was rated not qualified by the American Bar Association, ruled that masks may trap virus droplets, but do not clean anything, and therefore are not sanitation. Under that absurd logic, the CDC wouldn't be allowed to enforce a regulation against defecating on an airplane floor and could only require wiping up afterward. The reason passengers broke into applause, said National Review in an editorial, is that they were celebrating our mutual liberation from COVID theater. When people weren't wearing masks below their noses, they were pulling them down to eat or drink. What's the point in that? Commercial airplanes, moreover, have superb air circulation and filtering, and by now the vast majority of travelers are vaccinated and or have had a previous COVID infection. People put up with masks as a temporary emergency measure when we had no vaccines and hospitals were overwhelmed, said Megan McArdle in the Washington Post. But hospitalizations and deaths have plunged. If not now, when? Have we not learned anything from the past 2 years, said Dr. Arnold Barnett in The Hill. This isn't the first time we thought we were done with COVID, only to be hit by another debilitating surge. Vaccine effectiveness is waning, and a new Omicron subvariant known as BA2 has caused new cases to jump 70% since the end of March. We also need to consider the debilitating risks of long COVID, which can follow even mild infections, and the possible emergence of a new, more dangerous variant. Besides, planes aren't as safe as some might contend. Peer-reviewed studies have shown infected passengers transmitting COVID to 15 people on one flight and 14 on another. But in our collective pandemic fatigue, said Kent Sepkowitz in CNN.com, people are embracing the magical thinking that, by ignoring the virus, it will go away. It won't, but we need to be realistic, said David Lennart in the New York Times. The mask mandate on public transportation didn't require the N95 and KN95 masks that are proven to work, and was so poorly enforced and had so many exceptions that many Americans understandably questioned its worth. At this stage of the pandemic, it makes more sense to encourage people who fear COVID to voluntarily wear N95 masks. Experts say one-way masking works. Whether we like it or not, there is strong, growing resistance to mask mandates, and the best responses to health crises depend on triage. Public officials should give priority to COVID precautions that people will accept and follow, rather than trying to enforce the unenforceable. Here's our Good Week, Bad Week piece. It was a good week for Lucille Randon, a 118-year-old French nun who became the world's oldest living person after the death of Kane Tanaka, 119, of Japan. Randon is also the oldest known survivor of COVID. It was a good week for whiz kids after Elliot Tanner, 13, prepared to graduate from the University of Minnesota and begin a doctoral physics program. Elliot, his mom said, started reading when he was maybe two. And it was a good week for gutting it out after Minnesota State Senate candidate Aaron May, Quaid, spoke at a Democratic convention while in labor, pausing to exhale and lean over during contractions. Quaid did not get the nomination, but delivered a healthy baby girl hours later. But it was a bad week for a failure to communicate after the Federal Aviation Administration failed to warn Capitol Police that a small plane would fly overhead so it could drop an Army parachute team onto the field of a Washington Nationals baseball game. Alarmed police evacuated congressional staffers. It was a bad week for Representative Madison Cawthorn, the Republican from North Carolina, who was caught trying to bring a loaded handgun through an airport security checkpoint, the second time he's been cited for that offense. Cawthorn recently had his driver's license revoked after several speeding violations. Finally, it was a bad week for rewrites after Google suspended use of its new inclusive language tool that steered Google Docs users away from words like policemen or mankind. The website Vice found that the tool objected to motherboard and landlord and attempted to revise a speech by Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. The briefing this week is Living on the Streets. Major cities are cracking down on homeless encampments. But why are so many people living rough? How many are homeless? It's hard to determine with any certainty, but in January 2020, more than 580,000 people were homeless in the U.S. on a given night, with an estimated 226,000 of them sleeping outside, in cars, or in abandoned buildings. The 2021 numbers indicated an 8% decrease in homelessness, although that may be misleading. The pandemic delayed or suspended counts in half of the 400 communities that report data to the Department of Housing and Urban Development. During the height of the pandemic, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention advised against breaking up homeless encampments out of fear that dispersing people would spread COVID. And cities such as Dallas, Seattle, and Portland, Oregon saw double-digit growth in tent cities. In New York City, from 2,300 to 5,000 people are living on the streets, with 45,000 in shelters. In San Francisco, nearly 1% of the city's population of 875,000 are homeless. Mayor London Breed declared a state of emergency in the Tenderloin District last December after it became littered with human excrement and used syringes. Too many people are sprawled out all over our streets, Breed said, adding that homelessness has destroyed our city. Why do people become homeless? The reasons vary, but a few common factors stand out. One is mental illness. The deinstitutionalization and defunding of psychiatric care preceded a spike in homelessness in the 1980s. By 2015, one quarter of all homeless people were suffering from a serious mental disorder such as schizophrenia. Drug and alcohol use is also often a factor. More than a third of homeless shelter residents struggle with substance abuse disorders. But researchers say that the role of economic factors, particularly the cost and availability of housing, should not be underestimated. Many cities have seen housing costs skyrocket, and a 2018 Zillow study found that homelessness rises wherever people have to devote more than 32% of their income to rent. Poverty can trigger a downward spiral of domestic violence, arrests, jailing, and eviction, which in turn lead to drug use and psychological distress. You experience what they experience, said Pastor Wayne Walker, who runs a Dallas homeless mission, and you are going to have mental health problems too. What effect did COVID have? As closed businesses pushed the unemployment rate close to 15% in April 2020, federal and local governments mobilized to prevent an exponential surge of homelessness. Trillions in relief spending helped fund an 11-month eviction moratorium and let hard-hit cities and state house the homeless in newly vacant motels. COVID disruptions exacerbated another crisis, the opioid epidemic. In San Francisco, among homeless people doubled in 2020, 82% of them overdoses. How are cities responding? In response to a growing public outcry, many cities have returned to sweeping up camps of homeless people. The National Coalition for the Homeless reports that at least 65 communities now criminalize or systematically remove homeless camps. New York Mayor Eric Adams recently vowed to remove the approximately 1,000 people who are essentially living in the subway, and people cleared more than 300 outdoor camps within a month. But many who choose to live rough refuse to bunk up with hundreds of others in barracks-like shelters, where theft, lice infestations, and confrontations are commonplace. Some now also cite the fear of catching COVID. Homeless advocates argue that sweeps merely shuffle homeless people around and result in a loss of their belongings, with so many cities short of shelter and psychiatric beds, said Bill Johnson of the National Association of Police Organizations. Jail becomes the default. What else can be done? Some states, such as Alabama, Washington, and Texas, are clarifying their involuntary commitment laws to make it easier to hospitalize people with serious mental illness. Other states, aided by millions in pandemic relief funds, have adopted a housing-first approach, which prioritizes putting people under a roof before addressing issues such as mental illness and addiction. Dozens of tiny house communities, some based on Portland, Oregon's Dignity Village, provide transitional housing with more individual privacy than traditional shelters. Since 2007, the U.S. has added more than 373,000 units of permanent supportive housing, which a study in the medical journal The Lancet showed was 90% effective at preventing future homelessness. You heal better when you have a door that you can lock, said Gail Gilman of the San Francisco-based nonprofit All Home. But it takes an investment of millions by local governments to provide free housing for thousands of struggling people. And many advocates argue that any long-term solution must include market incentives for building more affordable and low-cost housing. Getting people off the streets takes consistent, intensive efforts, said San Diego Mayor Todd Gloria. This crisis did not emerge overnight, and it won't be solved overnight. Time for a few of the best columns of the week. We'll start with Zelensky's inspirational leadership. Why do we admire Volodymyr Zelensky? Asked Brett Stevens. Ukraine's courageous president has reminded the world how powerful political leadership can be and why freedom and democracy are worth defending. A former actor, Zelensky has responded to Russia's existential threat to Ukraine by becoming a true statesman, a David standing up to Putin's Goliath. His refusal to flee or wilt in response to Russia's brutal onslaught models courage and integrity and shows us that there are things for which civilized persons and nations must be prepared to fight if they aren't to perish. Zelensky's fierce resolve has inspired both Ukrainians and their Western allies to become their best selves. He's even had the guts to chastise foreign presidents and prime ministers for supportive words not backed up by action and arms. He's made Joe Biden a better president and NATO a better alliance. He has shaken much of the United States out of the isolationist stupor into which it was gradually falling, and forced Europe to stop looking away from Russia's descent into fascism. Zelensky's example gives us reason to hope our own troubled democracies may yet elect leaders who can inspire, ennoble, even save us. The GOP's nightmare scenario. On paper, Republicans have a prime opportunity to recapture the Senate majority this fall, said Russell Berman. But needing just one seat to turn a 50-50 Senate into a majority, they could blow it by nominating several extremist and scandal-plagued candidates. How could you screw this up? Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell recently asked in a speech in Kentucky. It's actually possible. That's because at least four candidates running in Republican Senate primaries have baggage that could render them unelectable in November. In Missouri, Eric Greitens is seeking the nomination despite a sexual misconduct scandal and accusations by his ex-wife that he abused her and their son. Former President Donald Trump has endorsed J.D. Vance in Ohio and Dr. Mehmet Oz in Pennsylvania. Despite their extreme flip-flops on issues ranging from abortion to Trump himself, whom Vance once compared to Hitler. Former football player Herschel Walker may win a primary in Georgia, despite a troubled past and accusations he threatened to kill his ex-wife. In a polarized political environment, will voters pull the lever for such tainted candidates? McConnell and the Republicans fear they won't. The Democrats worry they will. This comes from Europe. Macron, can he heal a divided France? Emmanuel Macron has achieved the impossible, said Nicolas Bertaut, by winning re-election over far-right challenger Marine Le Pen. The French president became the first to win two consecutive terms since Jacques Chirac in 2002. Now an empowered Macron can govern freed from the constraint of electoral deadlines. In his first term, France's youngest ever president quickly expelled the feudal lords of French politics by gathering moderate voters beneath his center-right Big Tent party, which kept Le Pen and the far-right firmly in check. His victory will brighten a gloomy year for Europe, said Andreas Ross in Frankfurter. His steady leadership has united the continent during Russia's brutal invasion of Ukraine, and Europe will need that leadership as it strengthens its continental defense and prepares to wean itself off Russian energy for good. In facing down the far-right nationalists at home, Macron did not appease them by leaning toward Euroscepticism. Instead, he doubled down on his core belief that Europe is the solution and showed Germany and other EU nations that we have a partner with guts. This is no time for Macron to celebrate, said Jerome Fenoglio. His victory confronts him directly with his failure to connect with a frustrated French working class. He won this time by firmly refuting the xenophobic program of Le Pen, but she still pulled in a troubling 41.5% of the vote, easily the best score for the far right in an election, and a record 16.7 million people did not vote at all. Now, with both Le Pen and the far-left party of third-place candidate Jean-Luc Mélenchon, eager to deny Macron a parliamentary majority in the June elections, Macron must be mindful of the abyss into which the country is ready to fall. Even in defeat, the French far-right and its anti-immigrant nationalist message demonstrated its growing and potentially limitless power of attraction, and its leader, be it Le Pen, Eric Zemmour, or someone else, will continue to exploit the fractures in French society. Macron spent his first term at loggerheads with populists over unpopular proposals such as raising the retirement age. He cannot leave this wound open. France's new fault lines have been laid bare, said Stefan Brandl, and they no longer run between left and right. Instead, it's Macron's liberal pro-business, pro-European camp on the one hand, and populists on the other, the moderate center against the radical fringes of the French political spectrum. Macron won votes in cities and high-income areas, while the working class supported Le Pen and Mélenchon. And while Macron successfully painted Le Pen as being in Vladimir Putin's pocket, the president often appeared more focused on the war in Ukraine than on the needs of the French people. Voters still see Macron's elitist, arrogant attitude as reminiscent of the aloofness of French kings. Will Macron ever pay attention to the coal blast furnaces of Lorraine and the closed coal mines of northern France? If not, his second term is unlikely to be any smoother than his first. And we're on to the last word, our feature article, titled this week, Living Next to the Doomsday Machine. For 50 years, Ed Butcher has worked the ranch right above a nuclear missile launch site, said Eli Saslow in the Washington Post. These days, the danger feels closer than it has in decades. Winifred Montana. Ed Butcher, 78, tied up his horse, kicked mud off his cowboy boots, and walked into his house for dinner. He's been working on the ranch for most of the day, miles away from cell phone range. What did I miss? He asks his wife, Pam, as he turned their TV to cable news. What part of the world is falling apart today? Russia's aggression has gone from scary to terrifying, the TV commentator said, as Pam took their dinner out of the oven. We're talking about a war that involves a very unstable nuclear power, the commentator said, as they bent their heads over the venison casserole to say prayer. This could escalate, the commentator said. It could explode beyond our wildest imaginations. Ed turned the TV off and looked out the window at miles of open prairie, where the wind rattled against their barn and blew dust clouds across Butcher Road. Ed's family had been on this land since his grandparents homesteaded here in 1913, but rarely had life on the ranch felt so precarious. Their land was parched by record-breaking drought, neglected by a pandemic work shortage, scarred by recent wildfires, and now also connected in its own unique way to a war across the world. I wonder sometimes what else could go wrong, Ed said, as he looked over the hill toward a west end of their ranch, where an active U.S. government nuclear missile was buried just beneath the cow pasture. Do you think they'll ever shoot it up into the sky? Pam said. I used to say no way, Ed said. Now it's more like, please, God, don't let us be here to see it. The missile was called a Minuteman III, and the launch site had been on their property since the Cold War, when the Air Force paid $150 for 1 acre of their land as it installed an arsenal of nuclear weapons across the rural West. About 400 of those missiles remain active and ready to launch at a few seconds' notice in Montana, Wyoming, North Dakota, Colorado, and Nebraska. It's buried behind a chain-link fence and beneath a 110-ton door of concrete and steel. It's 60 feet long. It weighs 79,432 pounds. It has an explosive power at least 20 times greater than the atomic bomb that killed 140,000 people in Hiroshima. An Air Force team is stationed in an underground bunker a few miles away, ready to fire the missile at any moment if the order comes. It would tear out of the silo in about 3.4 seconds and climb above the ranch at 10,000 feet per second. It was designed to rise 70 miles above the earth, fly across the world in 25 minutes, and detonate within a few hundred yards of its target. The ensuing fireball would vaporize every person and every structure within a half mile. The blast would flatten buildings across a five-mile radius. Secondary fires and fatal doses of radiation would spread over dozens more miles, resulting in what U.S. military experts have referred to as total nuclear annihilation. I bet it would fly right over our living room, Ed said. I wonder if we'd even see it. We'd hear it. We'd feel it, Pam said. The whole house would be shaking. And if we're shooting off missiles, you can bet some are headed back toward us, Ed said. I guess we'd head for the storage room. Make a few goodbye calls, Pam said. Hold hands, pray. Ed got up to clear his plate. Good thing it's all hypothetical. It's really only there for deterrence. It'll never actually explode. You're right, Pam said. It won't happen. Almost definitely not. Known to the government as Launch Facility E-05, the silo on Ed's Ranch is one of 52 active nuclear missile sites on the old Homestead Farms of Fergus County. The government had chosen to turn the lonely center of Montana into a nuclear hotspot in the 1950s because of what was described then as its relative proximity to Russia, and also because the region could act as what experts called a sacrificial nuclear sponge in the event of nuclear war. The theory was that rather than unloading all of its missiles on major U.S. cities, an enemy would instead have to use some of those missiles to attack the silos surrounding Winifred, Montana, home to 35,000 cattle and 189 residents whose birthdays and anniversaries were all printed on the official city calendar. Ed had only lived away from the ranch once during his life, when he went to college in Billings and then started a career as a professor in North Dakota. He'd been on his way toward a doctorate in U.S. history when his father had a heart attack in 1971, and his mother called to say she was planning to sell the ranch unless he wanted to move back to Montana. He was their only child. The butcher name was on the road, just like the Wickens and the Wallings and the Stokes and all of the other original Homestead families. Even though he loved teaching, he moved back with Pam to take over the ranch. When the military built the launch site during Ed's teenage years, he'd seen it mostly as a potential intrusion, a symbol of federal government overreach and what he called the insanity of the nuclear arms race. As a college professor, he'd driven a Volkswagen bus with a peace sign painted on the rear window, and Pam had attended a small protest against the Minuteman missiles at a federal building in rural North Dakota. They'd moved back to the ranch expecting that they might see some of the nuclear drama they'd heard about at other silos. Toxic chemical leaks, accidental near explosions, Russian spies, or groups of nuns who chained themselves to the silo fence in acts of protest. But instead, each time Ed went to check on the silo, all he found was wind and sky, and occasionally a cow entangled in the fence. The Air Force replaced the original Minuteman missile with a Minuteman II and then a Minuteman III. Military crews built better dirt roads on the Butcher Ranch. They plowed those roads in the winter. They provided jobs for electricians and contractors in Fergus County. They worked on the launch site, mostly under the cover of night, and, as far as Ed could tell, nothing much ever happened. The silo was a benign relic of the Cold War. It was 1 acre out of 12,000, or at least that's what Ed had thought until late February, when Russia invaded Ukraine and Russian President Vladimir Putin put his nuclear weapons on higher alert. I bet Russian satellites are counting the hairs on my head right now, Ed said. He looked up at the sky and then pulled his hat down toward his eyes. He turned away from the silo and headed back to check on the cows. I liked it better when this place felt like a piece of history, he said. Instead, at that moment, motion sensors were detecting any movement within 100 yards of the launch facility. Military helicopters were patrolling for suspicious activity across all 450 active missile sites in Montana, North Dakota, Nebraska, Wyoming, and Colorado. Two members of the Air Force team were beginning another 24-hour shift in a bunker 7 miles from the Butcher Ranch, where they took an elevator 60 feet below ground into a small room reinforced with 4-foot concrete walls. They had a tiny bathroom. They had a bed. They had an escape tunnel. They had a control panel where they could key in an 8-digit code to launch 10 nuclear missiles from Fergus County into the sky. And a few miles further down the road, Ed's youngest son was at the county courthouse, helping to work on the next generation of America's nuclear arsenal. Ross Butcher, 53, was one of three elected commissioners in Fergus County And lately, part of his job was to coordinate with the military as it began replacing the Minutemen III's with a new and more efficient nuclear weapon called the Sentinel. The Air Force was planning 31 new communications towers in Fergus County, 8 more control centers, 1,200 miles of high-speed underground wiring, 2 workforce hubs with 2,500 to 3,000 employees. Strong deterrence and protection into the 2070s and beyond. The material that the Air Force had sent to Fergus County promised. At the ranch, Pam Butcher had begun to wonder if mankind would survive that long. Everywhere I look, it's like humanity's moving toward its final hours, she said, because that's how she interpreted the recent wildfires, the droughts, the political instability in Europe, the erosion of American democracy, the inflation of the U.S. dollar, the coronavirus pandemic, and also the series of tragedies that had devastated her family in the past few years. Her brother and his wife had recently been killed in a collision with a semi-truck. Her son-in-law had died of the coronavirus in 2021. And Travis, her eldest, had suffered a fatal asthma attack in his sleep after working 16-hour days on the ranch in dust and wildfire smoke. The only way Pam could make sense of his death was by thinking that God needed Travis to help get things in order for a monumental event. Maybe God was preparing for the rapture, Pam thought. She'd started to get ready herself, storing several years of extra food supplies in the cellar and ordering dozens of books and DVDs from a Christian website. They sat in piles around the living room. Midnight Strikes, Final Age of Man, Realms of the Dead, Bad Moon Rising, Final Empire, and The Day the Earth Stood Still. Pam's plan was to go toward the cellar where she thought she'd stockpiled enough supplies for them to be self-sufficient for at least a few years. They had a freezer full of meat and 3,000 rounds of military-grade ammunition to hunt the deer and elk on their land. They had a generator, 10,000 gallons of diesel fuel, 20,000 gallons of propane. They could use their central fireplace to heat the whole house and their bushels of wheat to make fresh flour. Pam had gone online to buy water filtration devices, purification tablets, and more than a dozen five-pound survival kits that included evaporated soup and freeze-dried meals. That night, the temperature dropped below freezing. A snowstorm rolled in from the mountains, and Ed awoke to the sound of an emergency call. His grandson, Josh, had gone to check on the cattle a little after 3 a.m., and he'd found the second calf of the season lying motionless at the bottom of a ravine. The calf was only a few hours old, and it had stumbled away from its mother and fallen into a frozen creek bed. Josh had picked up the calf, carried it back to its truck, and turned up the heat. He'd driven back to the house and put the calf into an electric warming bed, but it was still cold and mostly unresponsive. "I think we're going to lose this one," Josh told Ed, but when they checked on the calf a few hours later, it had opened its eyes. It was sluggish but not dead, so they decided to drive it back onto the ranch to see if it could somehow reunite and bond with its mother. Ed's daughter-in-law drove the pickup truck past the missile silo and out toward the cow pasture. His 4-year-old great-granddaughter held the calf in the passenger seat, trying to hug it back to warmth. Ed and Josh sat in the bed of the truck, and then they dropped the calf into the field and tried to call over its mother. "Moo," Josh yelled. On the first try, the cow ignored them. But after Ed and Josh mended a nearby fence and started heading back towards the truck, Ed called out, "Moo," one more time. And the cow looked at him and then stood. She walked in the direction of her calf. She looked at it and eventually licked its head. She lay beside the calf and shielded it from the wind as the sun started to break through the clouds. Ed stood next to his great-granddaughter and watched for another few moments, until finally the cow prodded the calf onto its feet and led it back toward the herd. "How great is this?" Ed asked his great-granddaughter. There were no predators circling the cow pasture, no military helicopters patrolling above the ranch, no explosions coming from the silo over the hill. For the moment, it was just sky and wind and another new life awakening on the Butcher family ranch, where the missile was still buried below ground. A version of this story originally appeared in the Washington Post. Here's a health and science piece that caught my attention. Stop and smell the flowers. If you want to enjoy life, take a moment to stop and appreciate the small pleasures. Psychologists agree that those who feel their life matters tend to be happier. But now they have found that a sense of marvel makes a difference too, reports Scientific American. In a series of studies of more than 3,000 people, researchers asked participants to list their coping strategies for relieving stress in the early stages of the pandemic. They found that those who focused on appreciating everyday beauty reported experiencing life as more meaningful. Next, the researchers determined that people who had a strong appreciation for moments of beauty were also more likely to feel that their own existence was valuable, even after controlling for other aspects of psychological well-being. Showing participants an awe-inspiring video, such as the opening sequence of the BBC nature show Planet Earth, produced similar results. Appreciating small things can make life feel more meaningful, say study co-authors Joshua Hicks from Texas A&M and Frank Martella from Aalto University in Finland. We should slow down, let life surprise us, and embrace the significance of every day. And we'll flip over to the Talking Points page to finish out the show. Starting with that article about what's going on in Florida with Disney World. DeSantis versus Disney, the next phase of the culture wars. The Disney company has dominated Florida for so long that the very idea of a backlash from the state's political leaders was unimaginable, said Michael Hiltzik in the Los Angeles Times. But that was before Florida Governor Ron DeSantis, whose 2024 presidential ambitions are no secret, took on the role of quintessential right-wing culture warrior and decided to bring the hammer down on Disney for its perceived wokeness. Last week, DeSantis signed legislation passed by the GOP-controlled state legislature stripping Disney World in Orlando of a special agreement dating back to 1967 that gave the company full control over a 43-square-mile site of its theme park. Disney's offense? Company officials dared to speak out against a law, labeled Don't Say Gay by critics, that restricts the teaching of sex and gender issues in Florida elementary schools. The House of Mouse has been a golden goose for Florida, attracting 17 million visitors annually, generating billions in tourist dollars, and directly employing 80,000 workers and generating more than 400,000 jobs. Using government power to retaliate against what conservatives deem woke capitalism marks an inflection point for the GOP, said Matt Lewis in the Daily Beast. Once the party of business and free market economics, the Trumpified GOP has remade itself as a populist working class party that seeks to use the power of the state to fight back against progressive politics and culture. For many conservatives, that's thrilling. Let Disney be an example, said Rich Lowry in National Review. Company leaders, bullied by a woke segment of employees and outside progressives, opted to attack legislation that has nothing to do with Disney whatsoever. Disney's objections relied on a smear that the law threatened gay or trans people, when in reality the law merely seeks to prevent public schools from teaching young children inappropriate material, an objective that once would have been considered utterly banal. The governor and state legislature are fully within their rights to revoke the favoritism bestowed on the so-called Reedy Creek Improvement District, once dubbed the Vatican with mouse ears. Republicans don't want corporations to become tools in advancing their agenda. They just want them to exit the culture wars and focus, once again, on their business. What hypocrisy, said David French in The Atlantic. Just 3 years ago, conservatives were rightly furious at the San Antonio City Council for barring Chick-fil-A from operating in the local airport. The company was being punished for its Christian owners' alleged anti-LGBTQ behavior, but since no anti-discrimination laws were broken, banning it from a building clearly violated Chick-fil-A's First Amendment rights. Florida is emulating San Antonio, except on a much bigger scale. So thunderous online right-wing applause. Sure, no company is entitled to govern its own fiefdom, said Charles Cook in National Review. But Florida Republicans never showed any problem with Disney's special status until now. It's silly for DeSantis to pick this fight, since he has already fought Disney, and he has already won. The classroom bill is law and supported by broad majorities of Floridians. There's no need for Republicans to salt the earth here. In their haste to punish Disney, said Declan Garvey and Esther Eaton in The Dispatch, Republicans didn't seem to calculate how disastrous revoking the company's special status could be for Florida taxpayers. Disney heavily taxes itself, in effect, through Reedy Creek, funding upkeep for the roads, sewers, security, firefighting, and other public services needed for Disney World. If Disney's special status is revoked, Florida taxpayers will have to come up with the $163 million Reedy Creek has been collecting each year. Plus, neighboring Orange and Osceola counties could be on the hook for Disney's more than $1 billion in bond debt obligations. Punishing Disney for exercising its First Amendment-protected speech is clearly unconstitutional, said Ian Millhiser in Vox. In an email to supporters, DeSantis said Disney and other woke corporations won't get away with peddling their unchecked pressure campaigns any longer, making it blatantly clear he was punishing the company for daring to speak out against him. The message DeSantis is sending is clear, said Jonathan Chait in New York Magazine. The competent Trumpism he's offering Republicans is eerily similar to Viktor Orban's authoritarian grip on Hungary, where the government uses its power to protect traditional values and wage war against progressive secular forces. In DeSantis' Brave New World, political favors, such as Disney's self-governance in Orlando, are available only to those who stay in the party's good graces. What DeSantis is building in Florida is his blueprint for the country. And we'll wind down with a few short notes. Growing abuse from players and parents has led to a widespread exodus of youth sports umpires and referees, with shortages causing scores of canceled games and tournaments. From 2018 to 2021, an estimated 50,000 high school referees quit after being followed to their cars, attacked by players on the field, and struck by objects thrown by spectators. Guns were the leading cause of death for U.S. children and teens in 2020, surpassing car crashes for the first time in at least 40 years. More than 4,300 children and teens died of gun-related injuries that year, a 29% increase over 2019, according to an analysis of CDC data. Mark Meadows, the former chief of staff to Donald Trump, who promoted Trump's false claims of widespread voter fraud in the 2020 election, was until earlier this month simultaneously registered to vote in three different states, Virginia, South Carolina, and North Carolina. In North Carolina, Meadows had registered to vote using the address of a mobile home he didn't own and had never lived in. On the poll watch, 56% of Americans will still favor a mask requirement on planes and mass transit, including 80% of Democrats and 33% of Republicans. 71% of adults ages 60 and over want mask mandates. 49% of Americans think masks should be required for crowded public events. But only 20% of Americans are extremely or very worried about getting COVID. And we'll finish up with a quote from Hannah Arendt, quoted in The Bulwark, who says, "Every generation, civilization is invaded by barbarians. We call them children." And with that, we have run out of time for today's episode of the week. Be sure to listen again next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. This is Fred Woodward reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The week is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. For more information or if you have comments or questions, please give us a call, 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. And thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.